Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, we're coming up onto Thanksgiving, and I'm imagining that most of you people have thought through the brining of the big bad bird and are also turning your thoughts to the sweets to follow.
Okay, I wonder where you were going with that. I thought there's no turkey in here that I know anything about.
Oh no.
But there are four.
Lots of sweets.
There are four lovely
ladies. All different kinds of tastes.
Well, there are four lovely ladies, all with a different take on what it means to provide people with sweet treats and some savory treats too, included on the menus they provide and the books that they've written that brought us to the program today. So, Joanne Chang, who's a mathematician, I think. Some kind of scientist turned successful restaurateur in Boston.
And she just gave a fantastic lecture at Harvard that she's getting all kinds of applause for.
Well, I can understand why, because she's a very coherent lady, and she has purpose in mind. She explains everything she's doing just beautifully, and you should be fortunate to hear her here and rush out and get her book so you can cook the things that she cooks too. So here's Joanne Chang. Flower 2 is the name of one of her shops. I think she now has four. So,
well, I think it's Flower 2.
Well, it's a play on
up of her first book, yeah,
it's a clever play on words, I guess, but it's T-O-O, not T-W-O, for whatever reason, I don't know.
Anyway, let's
get to the interview.
We've talked to Joanne Chang before. Joanne, it was after your first book called Flower?
Yes.
Yes. And this current book is Flower 2. And I remember being so impressed with how lucid you are and how well you explain things, your ideas and your techniques. You now own, is it four flower cafes?
Correct.
And you do more than just bakery.
Oh, yeah. The bakeries are bakery and cafes. And so there's a whole entire savory side of flour that I explain in the second book, Flour 2, where we go through breakfast, lunch, dinner, and party time. So we do sandwiches, soups, salads, pizzas, quiche, the whole shebang. And all of that is in this second book.
Right inside the cover, it looks like a chalkboard, because I guess it is a chalkboard. But the way it's all written on reminds me actually of a classroom. You were so organized. And is this because you were initially trained as a mathematician?
Yes. It is a little bit type A in that way. And I am very, very organized and a bit of a control freak, so to speak. And so the recipes definitely reflect that. I think the bakery cafes reflect that as well. That inside cover that you're talking about is our menu board. We have a detailed menu board where we list all of our drinks and all of our sandwiches. And one of the nice things about that board, too, is that lately we've been realizing how many people have allergies, and so we also try to list all the different allergy demarcations. So if something is gluten-free or nut-free or vegan or vegetarian, it's on that board.
I'm trying to look, too. Are there symbols for that?
Yeah, we just use initials, NFGF, okay. V, and VEG.
Now, you started your operation what year?
In 2000, about 13 years ago.
Oh, is it that really long ago?
Yeah, it feels crazy that it's been that long.
The way you organize this book, I think, is going to be so helpful for people using it. I'm thinking that I could actually take any one of these recipes and make something that tastes like I would get in your cafe.
Yes, I certainly hope so. That is the goal. We are so lucky. We have guests that come to visit us breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so when it came time to organize the book, it just seemed like the natural way to set it up. You know, we have people who come in the morning, and there's obviously the people who enjoy sweets. But then there's a lot of our customers don't necessarily want something sweet. They want something a little bit savory. So we have breakfast pizzas, ham and cheese pockets, breakfast egg sandwiches, oatmeal. So we have all of these different options, which are in the book as well. And then going into lunch and going into dinner, all of these recipes are things that we offer every day. So the great thing is, for a home cook, you know that the recipes have been tested over and over and over, because this is literally what we make every single day.
And you make a lot of them. I mean, you said something about 1,000 cookies.
Oh, yeah.
Is that from one of your shops?
That is, it depends on the location. Each location has a different level of busyness. But, yeah, we have, in terms of pastries, we have over, I would say, 7 or 8 dozen different types of pastries. And so then the number of each pastry that we sell can vary from a dozen to 3 or 4 dozen. So we were trying to add up the number of cookies, 2 dozen different kinds of cookies, and then we just sell dozens and dozens of each. So it ends up being in the high hundreds and up to 1,000.
Now, you explain a lot of the how you operate in your introduction. I have a question. Did you really go through a phase where you had sweets for breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Oh, yeah. I realized, I feel like it was probably around college when I left home to go to college and I had a little bit more control over what I could eat. You know, when you're growing up at home, you eat what your parents give you or what they buy and stock the fridge and the pantry with. When I went off to college and I was on my own in terms of feeding myself, that's when it really came out, and I noticed that for breakfast I was getting a cinnamon raisin bagel, and for lunch, and I know this isn't very healthy, but I would go get some ice cream and a sweet, and then for dinner I'd pick at something for dinner, but then I would have a piece of cake, and that would be like the bulk of my meal. I have an incredible sweet tooth that I'm always, always thinking about sweets, to the point where I have to kind of force myself to eat regular food, because if I don't make a conscious effort, I will simply just eat sweets all day long.
See, now I'm just the opposite. So I'm Oh, yeah. I have no sweet tooth whatsoever.
Oh, wow.
It's weird.
I couldn't even imagine that.
I know. Our son really suffered from that. He has a sweet tooth.
Yeah.
I have to mention right at the outset that part of the success of this book is, I mean, the photographs are stunning.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Just beautifully executed. And the other is the organization. I don't know that anybody could read this without knowing what you're about. You go into every detail.
Great to hear. I mean, that was definitely my goal. I wanted to give people who don't come to Flower every day a full sense of what it's like. And not only just from a customer point of view, but hopefully give them a sense of what it's like if you are in the kitchen and if you work there, just so that you know what goes on behind the scenes in order to create all of these incredible foods. And so I love hearing that you've been able to, that when you read it, you kind of got that sense.
Oh, I love your, the diary of a day.
Yeah.
Your first bakers come in and so forth. And then when the savory chefs come in, I love that. Fighting over storage space.
Oh, every day.
I know it. So anyhow, you have sections on In Our Vocabulary, which just defines exactly what you mean by these terms that everybody reads, such as based. Based, in your terms, means something specific.
Right.
And that's what you do. And then you move on in our pantry, and by that you mean pantry.
Right.
Spices, herbs, grains, and flours. Then you actually have a variety of sweeteners, don't you? Brown sugar, confectioner's sugar, honey, pearl sugar, sanding sugar, which I never even heard of.
You may have seen it. It's the large crystalline sugar that a lot of bakeries will sprinkle on the top of their desserts, and it gives it a little bit sparkle, so it doesn't just kind of dissolve away. A lot of times if you just sprinkle something with regular sugar, you can't really see it, and it ends up baking into the baked good. But sanding sugar is a lot bigger. It's like the size of like a sesame seed, or maybe even a little bit bigger, so it stays on top, and you can see it, and it sparkles a little bit.
Yes, and you have jarred and canned items, a surprising number of spicy things.
We do use a lot of spice. It's funny. I don't think anyone's ever even noticed that. But now that you say it, that is all of the chefs that I have 4 different chefs, and they've all worked at a lot of different restaurants. And I think one of the things that they're really good at is about seasoning dishes. So I feel like they have a good repertoire of spicy things that they choose from. And we do try to vary it so that not everything is spicy, because we recognize that not everybody is into that.
Yeah, but you have so many regulars. I guess you really get to know their tastes.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Then you have in our refrigerator. You always have certain cheeses, eggs, butters.
Yeah, I mean, we have so many things. I call it our walk-in, because it is a fridge that is big enough for you to walk in. And I for this chapter, I walked into our walk-in and just looked at all the things that I know we use every day and tried to give readers a sense of what we use to make our recipes, where you can source it, how to store it, how long it lasts, just anything that would help you when you're in the grocery store trying to shop for these recipes, anything that would help you in terms of selecting the right product.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just filling pages. You provide a lot of helpful hints and tips in these sections, don't you?
Yeah, that's definitely my goal. It's funny because my husband, when he saw the first draft of the manuscript, he was like, wow, anybody could take this and just open a cafe with it. And it's true. I didn't hold back. There was no reason for me to hold back. It does list every single thing in a very real way in terms of stocking a pantry, a refrigerator, your cabinet, so that you can make all of these recipes.
Okay, how about the section called In Our Heads?
That's my favorite section. A bunch of tips that I called together as I was writing the book. As I was writing the book and testing all of these recipes, I knew that there were things that I was doing just intuitively because I'd done them my whole professional career. And I started to take note of these things because I wanted to share them with you, the reader, so that you knew where we're coming from, where we who work in professional kitchens, how our minds think. And some of the things I thought might be too simplistic, and then I would go hang out with a friend, not a professional cook, and just we'd be, you know, hanging out together one afternoon and just cooking together, and I'd realize, you know what I think is too obvious is actually not too obvious. And so I made sure to take the In Our Heads chapter and really put down, they're not even secrets, but just all of the habits that are so ingrained in any professional cook to allow you to then cook more successfully at home.
Well, you can tell people who are experienced cooks by one in particular called Clean As You Go.
Absolutely, yes. And that's something I had to learn. Started in professional kitchens, I didn't know that. And I got made fun of and teased and even ridiculed sometimes because I was so messy. But it was a good, good lesson to learn. And when I finally learned, it's like a light switch goes on. You learn it, it becomes part of you, and then you then look at other people. And when you see that they're not cleaning as they go, you're like, how can you cook that way? You forget that you yourself were that way just a little while previously, but that is definitely one of those tips that I think that every home cook could benefit from.
And the other one I like is think about uses for foodstuffs you would normally throw away.
That came from one of my best chefs. Reached out to all the chefs and I said, hey, I'm doing this chapter In Our Heads. What are things that you think that home cooks don't think about? And Aniceto, who's been with me for almost 8 years, he came up with that. And it's something, again, that's so intuitive to us because we just look at food as, wow, we have this opportunity to make all these great things with all this food. What can we do with all of it? And he's the master at taking the ends of produce or the little bits of Parmesan rind and just knowing, wow, we should do something with it. We have tons and tons of extra bread ends at the end of the day. He makes breadcrumbs. He makes croutons. He'll make bread salad. And it's really a way to utilize everything that you have in your kitchen. And it really pushes you to be creative. And you can really make some really delicious things if you're thinking about how to use every single food item that you have.
I'll tell you, with my cold, what I'd really like now is Mama Chang's hot and sour soup.
That is my mom's famous hot and sour soup, which we actually serve at the restaurant I have with my husband, Myers and Chang. And this is a little bit of a simplified version for the home cook, but it does offer all the things that would help you in your cold. It's really punchy. It's very pungent. It's got a lot of bright acid and then a lot of heat. There's a lot of pepper, and there's also sriracha, so it gives you kind of that sinus-clearing heat.
Oh, I'd like that. Joanne, where are you? Anyhow, you mentioned your husband is a chef.
Christopher's not a chef. He's a restaurateur. He does front of the house, wine, marketing, hospitality, design. He kind of takes care of the front, whereas I focus more on the back end.
Well, I was just aiming for a different question. Is like when you're hiring, you have a chef at each one of these restaurants. Now, when you're doing pastry, you have really specific recipes. And as you said, you're a bit of a control freak.
Right.
But you could control what the pastries are coming out of each one of these bakeries.
Right.
But the cafe, savory chefs are different.
Exactly.
What do you look for when you're hiring for this chef?
Well, when we're hiring a chef, which is, you know, it's something that we rarely have to do. We have chefs who've been with us for 8 years, 6 years, 7 years, and then we just did get a new chef at one of our locations. But typically we don't have to hire too often. But when we are hiring, we're looking for somebody who makes really delicious, simple food. I really don't want somebody who thinks that they're working at a 4-star restaurant. I mean, there's definitely a place for that, but that's not what we do. And so we look for somebody who focuses on flavors. I mean, we're all about getting, you know, the best produce we can from local farms when we can. We have, each location has kind of a different type of clientele, and so we try to find, make sure that our chefs are focusing on the types of foods that that clientele might prefer. And really, they have to be somebody who just honestly just loves to cook, because this is the type of job where you're cooking every single day for literally thousands of people. We have thousands of customers that come and see us, and so you're making soups and salads and dinner specials and quiche and pizza to feed 1,000 people. You need to really love food, and so we test them by, and we train them and interview by just having them cook for us, and we watch to see how they cook, what they take advantage of, what they want to order. If somebody comes in and it's the height of summer and they want to do something with apples and walnuts and, you know, squash and potatoes, then I know that that's probably not the right fit for us, because, you know, in the middle of summer we're looking at squash and tomatoes and, I mean, not squash, we're looking at tomatoes and, well, zucchini squash and all different types of summer produce.
Right. Now, you mentioned simple food. I love the story. You were working with Payon.
Yes.
I mean, the ultimate, well, I don't want to say the word fussy, but, you know, that's my association with French pastries.
Right.
And you would work with all these other fancy pastry chefs. And you, it occurred to you, you said, nobody made a really wonderful chocolate chip cookie. I love that story.
Yeah, I hope Francois's not mad at me. I learned so much working for a French pastry chef. It was invaluable, and I really did pick up a lot of skills, a lot of flavor combinations that I hadn't really thought about before. And I do love French pastry, but for me personally and for what I ended up developing for Flower, it was a much simpler approach. Where it was less, the focus was less on presentation, it was less on garnishes, and it was just more on making sure that whatever it was that we were making, that every single bite was incredibly delicious. I have a test for anything that we put on our menu that when I eat it, I can't stop eating it. Oh. And that's really how we test things. Like, somebody will bring me something and say, hey, I'm thinking about adding this to menu, what do you think? If I take a sip or a bite and I'm like, okay, that's okay, I know it's not ready. I need to take a sip or a bite and then think, oh my gosh, I want a whole bowl of this, or I want a whole pastry of this, or whatever it is that we're doing. And that's how I kind of gauge whether or not something is ready for us to put on our menu.
Well, I mean, I think that whoever gets this book is going to be really amazed, because we've been talking about simple foods. But
yes,
that's not to say these are not really interesting recipes. They're inventive. They are different from the classics that they're based on.
Right.
And the variety is such that you want to keep going back and back to making one after the other of these recipes and eating it. I think congratulations is in order.
Again, thank
you. You did it, and I really need that Mama Chang sauce.
I wish I could bring you some.
Oh, I wish so, too. Anyhow, thanks for talking to us again.
My pleasure.
Okay, and good luck with your book and all your restaurant ventures.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joanne.
Okay, bye-bye.
And we'll be back with another beautiful lady right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay.
Next up, we're talking cupcakes with Allison Rovicelli, although we have to say that her husband, Matt, is a partner in both her business and the books. And between the two of them, this is one hilarious cookbook. It is so, so funny. And so is our talk with Allison. But you pointed out something very sweet.
It's a heartwarming story and a couple of other perspectives as well. Allison and Matt fell in love, and while they were designing cupcake recipes together, And then their marriage almost fell apart as their business was falling apart right after the 2008 great crash on Wall Street. And the great part of the story is they're back in love again. They have two small children and a very successful business selling the most stupendously wonderful cupcakes.
Grown-up cupcakes.
Grown-up cupcakes. And the people have flown in from thousands of miles away to get some. So it's, as I said, it's a heartwarming story and a wonderful description of how you can get involved in a business and make it a part of your life. And you'll want to rush out and figure out how to make these wonderful cupcakes as well, because they're not just your mother's cupcakes.
Nope. Well, we have half the team of Robicellis, Allison Robicelli, and Matt Robicelli, her husband, is somewhere, but I don't know quite where, but that doesn't matter. We have you, Allison, and your wonderful book called Robicelli's Cupcakes. No, it's actually Robicelli's A Love Story with Cupcakes.
That's right.
And I'm telling you, it is, well, it's sérieux, as you say, but it's also hilarious and wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for reading it. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's nothing cutesy about it. It's solid, straightforward recipes. Even your list of ingredients is hysterical.
I really wanted to make that part entertaining because I collect cookbooks, and I realized that I don't think I've ever really read that section in my life. You know, because, and that's an important section. You should know, like, the difference between different types of butter. But it always reads like it's so laborious to get through, and it's like a textbook. So I'm like, let me make it funny. Oh, and then people can get through it.
Cartoons in here, you have photographs in here, and your language is very straightforward, like you're a friend,
salty.
A neighbor. Hmm?
Salty language.
Salty.
Yes.
So anyhow, tell us a little bit about how this is organized.
Well, like I said, I'm a big fan of the cookbook genre. I've been reading cookbooks since I think I learned to read. And when I decided I wanted to write a cookbook, I wanted to definitely put something new on it. And I'm very well known for the blog I write and for my Twitter account.
And your blog is?
It's on Robicellis.com. It started off as our website a few years ago, and what had happened was it was very straightforward and just kind of listing the flavors of the day. And as we started getting more and more popular, I started getting home later and later at night. So as it gets later, it's kind of harder to put on, like, your professional talking face. So I'm coming at 3 a.m., and I'm like, ah, the hell with it. And I'm just kind of writing like I speak. And I'm 33 years old, and I've spent all 33 years in Brooklyn, and a very funny and sarcastic, sardonic person. So I just started joking around on the internet, and it exploded in popularity. And then I started getting asked to write humorous articles for different websites. First I asked to write for Nona Brooklyn. I don't think that's around anymore, but the year I started writing, we were nominated for a James Beard Award for group blog. Then I started writing for Eater. I've been writing for Medium.com. And when I decided to write a cookbook, I was like, well, there has to be room for, like, a funny woman in this genre. And not, like, in a sort of a joking way, but this can be a serious cookbook with serious recipes, but it doesn't have to take itself seriously.
Exactly.
That's something I really feel, A, coming from the Brooklyn food scene, and B, being somebody who has over a decade in the business, that kind of scares me where we've been heading as chefs. Like, we've almost gotten so pompous and so full of ourselves that we've forgotten that this is supposed to be fun and it's nurturing and it's the service business. So as much as I take our food seriously, and Matt and I take our recipes very, very, very seriously, but we can't take ourselves seriously.
You always write your recipes. Now, you both are pastry chefs.
Yes.
Now, every time I pick up a section of the book and read it, you're writing cupcake recipes in bed. What is that about?
Oh, when we met, it's funny. People always ask if we met in a restaurant or worked together, which is completely not true. As I mentioned in the book, we met in a bar. And the story of the 50 cupcake recipes sort of tells the story of our marriage in different sections. It shows how we met and how we fell in love with each other and then how we started a business and then a family and then how we lost our first business. And I was actually surprised when we started putting the recipes together, realizing how much the recipes actually very much illustrated the past, God, 9 years of our lives in so many ways. And he's a very big inspiration to me. He's the smartest guy I know. He's the best chef I know. And we have so much fun together, just writing recipes.
You sound like it, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, that was sort of always our thing. Like, when we started dating, actually before we started dating, the first night we met, he came back to my place, and we stayed up till 10 o'clock in the morning writing recipes and reading cookbooks. And I know that sounds like, so silly. But, like who has a guy over and stays up all night and writes recipes? But that was us. And, like, our first date was we drove down to Brighton Beach here in Brooklyn, which is a Russian neighborhood. And we're like, let's go look for ingredients we've never seen before and then go cook with them. Great. So it's sort of like our way of flirting, where we'll just sit there and we'll come up with an idea for something. And then we keep pushing each other, and we go back and forth and develop new ideas together. So we have 50 recipes in the book. I think we've released over 300 flavors in the time we've been together as a company.
Wow.
And we have over like 500 or 600 just written out, and that's just on cupcakes. I mean, that's not counting pies or scones or all the other stuff we make. And I don't know if we'll ever be able to make everything that we write together. You know, I mean, you guys are a married couple over there. You know what it's like to work with somebody who just, like, challenges you and pushes you, and how it makes your work better, especially when it's somebody that you can both respect and you trust and occasionally yell at.
Yeah.
I was interested that you've answered my first question, which is you don't find cupcakes confining. You don't find you've made your field too narrow. When did you first decide that cupcakes were going to be it?
It was an accident. We had had a gourmet/sandwich shop in our neighborhood in Brooklyn, and we'd spent our life savings putting it up, and 4 days after we opened was the stock market crash of 2008.
Oh, Jesus.
So within 4 days, we went from, like, yeah, we're at the top of the world to, like, oh, crap, we just lost everything, and we lost all our customers, and we were trying to figure out what to do. And I, at the point, was not baking. Matt was not baking. I had 2 children under the age of 2 at home. They're 16 months apart, our boys, so having like an 18-month-old and like an infant was not working. And someone came in asking for a cake. He had actually had a cake I used to make for another restaurant. I said, okay, I need the money. I'll make you a cake. And then he came back the next week for another cake. And he said, I'd buy one of these cakes every day if you made them every day. So
oh, wow.
We sort of had that aha moment, like, well, no one's going to buy like 40 carrot cakes a day. But if I make cupcakes out of them, then they're going to come in and buy one of those and then maybe buy a sandwich or something like that. So that's what we started doing. Honestly, we thought we were going to be making like 4 dozen cupcakes a week. Really, we had no idea. We thought we started opening a bakery department. We made cupcakes. We made some cookies. We were making bars just really to supplement the sandwiches. And after a couple of weeks, a food blogger comes, tries one of the cupcakes. It goes up, this is the best cupcake in New York City.
Oh, great.
And then I have people, and this is funny because this was in 2009, so cupcakes had already been over for like 10 years or something like that.
Right.
Within weeks, all these food bloggers start showing up. People start driving in from New Jersey, from Connecticut. One guy came from Minnesota. We had tourists who were like staying in Manhattan coming out to our neighborhood. And mind you, our neighborhood is not really close to the center of Manhattan. People don't understand how big New York City is. We're maybe like a 45-minute subway away from Midtown. So people are getting on the subway for like an hour or so just to try one of these cupcakes. And we're like, oh, wait, we have something here, don't we? And it went from making 4 dozen a week to making like several thousand a week, point where we realized that we had 2 businesses going on. We had a gourmet shop, sandwich shop that was failing miserably. We had a bakery that was beginning to explode, and we had 2 kids at home who weren't seeing their parents anymore. And we had a marriage that suddenly wasn't working anymore because we didn't see each other, and we were broke. We were really broke. You go from having not an iota of debt and perfect credit and a nice little nest egg in the bank to suddenly having a credit score of like 2 and more debt than you can possibly imagine because everything collapsed around you. And we came together and we're like, we can't do this. We have to sort of like raise the field, so to speak, and figure out what's working and try again. So that's exactly what we did. We closed the business 4 years ago this month. It was October of 2009. And we closed and we started again with a bunch of quarters. We stole them up from my kids' piggy bank.
Yeah, I wondered. You said you used the borrowed quarters.
Yeah.
But you didn't tell me you stole them from your kids'
piggy bank. Yeah, borrowed, stole. I mean, I gave them their lives. So, I mean, it was an even exchange. So, yeah, we went into the kids' piggy bank, and we had no money. And I went to an old friend of mine who owned a bar, And I asked him, I was like, oh, can I just borrow your kitchen? Because my oven didn't even work. And if you've ever tried to cook anything in a New York City apartment, it's like a feat amongst itself.
Yeah.
So I was like, can I borrow your oven? And he was a big fan of ours, and he was a small business owner, and he knew that we had just, like, lost everything. And he's like, no problem. He's like, don't even pay me. Just take care of yourself and take care of the kids. And we took all the quarters of my kids' piggy bank, and they went to my parents. I was like, can I just have some bills? Because if I go to, like, Costco or BJ's with this, they're going to throw me out. So they changed my quarters. And my mom gave me some flour she had and some sugar. And we went and we bought butter and we bought eggs. And we started with two stores. And we would bake and we put them in the back of my Honda Civic. And we put my babies in the back of the Honda Civic. And we go and we drive around and we talk to everybody. And everybody said no, except for two places. And then two places very slowly turned into three. And then it turned into four. And at this point, like, my parents are sending food for us to eat. And I remember Matt, one of Matt's old friends, was managing a Burger King. And we'd go to the Burger King right after it closed. And they make all these burgers to just sit there. And everything they didn't throw out at the end of the night, they'd give to us so we would have food to eat. And
yeah, well, you're past this now because you're going past wholesale. You're opening another shop.
And now, that's sort of what happened. I'm like, in the book, I didn't want to – I feel like a lot of people out there kind of gloss over the hardships of running a business in a post-recession economy or running a small business, period. A lot of people put it on TV, especially these reality shows where everybody's just swimming in money and – overnight successes, and I don't think there's really much of a thing as an overnight success. You can see my cookbook and just learn about me right now, but there's a lot of hard work that goes in behind it.
And these are not like your usual, let's get this out there, these are not your usual cupcakes. These are very sophisticated adult cupcakes, you call them. No pink sprinkles or multicolored sprinkles or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why we got that reputation, because we never set out to make cupcakes. We set out to make cake like the ones we used to make in these fancy restaurants in Manhattan. We just wanted to make them smaller. So instead of making like a $10,000, like six-tier wedding cake, we just made an individual portion of it. So I don't think we made a vanilla cupcake until we were like 3 years old as a company. That was not even like one of our first flavors introduced. We have, God, what is in that book? There's a lot of recipes. There was always like, okay, we're going to make a chocolate cake and oh, we'll put some peanut butter on top of it. And then it was, oh, wait, I have some, it's really good with chocolate and peanut butter pretzels.
Oh, I'm looking. You picked my mind. I'm just staring at this cupcake right now.
That's probably one of the easiest recipes in the book.
Delicious.
At that point, like, it was funny. I don't think anybody in New York City was making a cupcake like that. And I'm like, why wouldn't you put chocolate and peanut butter and pretzels together? Or chocolate and caramel and pretzels? So, for us, we have this classical training, and we have these ideas as pastry chefs on how you compose a dessert. It's not just like frost. It's never cake frosting, food coloring, sprinkles. That's not how we work. We think texture. We think flavor. We think if you have something sweet, add something tart or salty, or add some acid to balance it. If something's really very soft, like if we're soaking a cake, like our tres leches cake,
yeah,
we do a brown butter cake and soak it with the three milks. And then we add the caramel shards on top, and it's very pretty in the book, like a decoration, but the reason we did that was because you have such a soft cake that crunch, that little bite, it kind of wakes you up. That textural contrast and flavor contrast, they wake up your mind, and they make you completely 100% present when you're eating. I don't think anybody should be, like, phoning it in when you're eating dessert, because it has 20 billion calories.
So, in a way, your secret is out, because 50 of your best recipes are in this book, but people are going to have to buy it and read it all the way through to find out the secrets. Is the one real elemental secret that you think is the reason why your cupcakes have been so successful?
The French buttercream.
Well, I don't know. Let Allison answer the question.
I think she's right, French buttercream. French buttercream, when you taste it, is just one of the most amazing things in the world. And I'm going to take absolutely no credit for this because, I mean, Matt and I did not invent this at all. It is something we both learned early in our careers. And, like, the first time you eat it, you're like, oh, my God, what is that? So very fun. I think this story is actually in the book. I remember going to a cupcake shop when they first started getting really big and not really understanding what was going on in there. And then when I met Matt, I commented to him, I was like, why can't people just use French buttercream on things? And he's like, I know, right? And we had no idea that, like, in 2 years we were going to do this. So when we did make cupcakes, again, not planning to make thousands of them a week, we're like, well, let's put French buttercream on everything and let's do everything the hard way. And it would be so much easier and probably cost effective for us to do things the easy way, but that was never the point of this company. The point of the company was to make something like really, really crazy, sexy, indulgent for one person. That you're eating this cupcake and you feel like the most special person in the world because this is yours.
I've never seen a cupcake with ghost chilies in it, by the way.
When we found out about ghost chilies, I forgot, we did an event, and I was next to a guy who was importing them, and he was like one of the first people to really start a business where he was importing ghost chilies, and I was like, wow, I'm like, I need to do something with this. That's how we get 99% of our inspiration. I think that's next to the when is the cupcake bubble going to burst question, the most common question I'm asked is, how do you come up with your flavors? And it's super easy. We look for amazing ingredients, and we work backwards from there.
And you know what? I think that just reading your titles, I mean, it's just, the book itself has so much broad appeal, and the titles are just amazing. It's something, it's very different from your run-of-the-mill baked goods book. You know that.
I mean, what we wanted to do is kind of make it.
Your personality is in everywhere, including in the half-ass corner notes.
I fully understand, as someone who collects cookbooks, people don't necessarily cook out of cookbooks anymore. If people are looking for, like, a very straight recipe, they kind of go online. I wanted to make a cookbook for people who would, A, bake, but there was people who just liked the pictures, or people who were just kind of looking for ideas, and people who think that they can't bake. And I'm very honest about it, the fact that I think a lot of baking books give you this false sense of hope. That they do, because we always say, you know, baking is a science and everything's exact, and you come out with this crazy idea that if I just follow this recipe to the T, like magic, it's going to look exactly like what came out of this book. And it's not as simple as that. I hate to break, you know, I mean, yes, you have to measure. Yes, there is a lot of science to it, but I've been in the business 10 years. I still mess things up, and there's a reason. I mean, if this wasn't a hard thing to do, everybody would just do it. I wouldn't have a job, you know? You become a professional by making a lot of mistakes. And I'm very upfront of that in the beginning of the book. I want people to try. If you mess up, it's okay. It's okay. That's how you learn things. But we really need to stop intimidating people about baking. And it's okay to try, and it's okay to fail, and it's okay to have fun in the kitchen. And if you're not having fun in the kitchen, you should probably not be in the kitchen. Go to a bakery, because I won't have a job if you don't go to the bakery.
It's been fascinating to talk to you. We wish you well. I'm going to coin a phrase I'm stealing mostly from somebody else called Build a Better Cupcake, and the world will beat a pathway to your door. I'm so glad there's a second chapter of your retail business. We wish you every success, although I'm sure you won't even need the Sex and the City girls to come, because people are already going to come from all over. So we thank you for joining us today. Very best regards to Matt.
Yeah, and tell him meeting him.
And your two little ones, Atticus and Toby.
Yes, I cannot wait. I really hope when the next time you guys are in New York City, please look us up. Please come visit. The kitchen that we're building, it's going to have a big open kitchen. You know, we're going to be showing people the process of baking and hopefully getting people really connected to their baked goods again. They shouldn't come out of a box from a pharmacy.
Oh, please.
They shouldn't come from a big box store where, you know, they're just coming off a rack or in saran wrap. So the more we teach people about baking, the more they're going to realize, like, this is dessert. Again, say that in the book. It's about 1 billion calories. They should make them count.
Exactly.
So please, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for enjoying the book, and please come visit.
And we will go visit, even though Anne's not a great fan of cupcakes. We'll still go, because they're obviously very, very interesting people in a very interesting neighborhood. And it's nice to celebrate their success with them. And we'll be back, of course, with another great lady in the dessert department right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. .net.
Well, as a sign of the times, we cannot just assume that everybody's going to eat these sweets, traditional sweets, or even variations of traditional sweets, because there's going to be somebody in your group, your dining group, that's vegan. A vegetarian or has an allergy.
Okay. Is that in this book?
Yes, this is Pies and Tarts
with
Hearts.
Oh, these are
by Denise Belcavage.
Oh, okay. I was getting it mixed up because the next interview also has something to do with vegans.
Yeah, well, there are lots of vegans.
Yeah, it's altogether too many vegans, but never mind.
That is a terrible thing to say. Yeah, I mean, that's called bias beyond belief.
Spoken as a true omnivore or carnivore or whatever it is.
But the trick is, of course, as we get more and more into this frame of mind and style of eating, is to make stuff taste better even than it did when it was not vegan.
But you better have a book to be your guide, because it's not the easiest thing in the world to do, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, Denise tackles things that you're going to want to know about, like apple pie, pumpkin pie, and key lime pie, all for Thanksgiving.
And for your vegan relatives, and probably because they really taste good anyway.
Yes.
I bet her recipes just taste absolutely wonderful. It sure sounds like it. Anyway, here she is.
Denise Belcavage. Did I do that right?
Belcavage.
Denise Belcavage. And that's an unusual name, and your Denise is spelt with a Y, in case anybody's looking you up. It's D-Y-N-I-S-E. And you have a blog. How long has that been going on, your blog?
My blog, urbanvegan.net, I started in 2006, so it's one of the... I think one of the first foodie blogs out there. It's been quite a while.
Right. And what got you started blogging about food?
Well, a few things. One, I'm interested in new technology. I always have been. But two, I had just turned vegan in 2006. I had just gone vegan. And I felt kind of alone in my dietary choice. And I found that on the blogosphere, as we like to call it, there were lots of like-minded people, and we shared recipes and ideas and encouragement, and that's how I got started. And I started posting my recipes, and I got really very good response to my recipes, so I kept it up. And by day, I work in advertising with a background in design and writing, so it was a natural fit for me.
Now, the title of the book, before we forget even to mention it, is Pies and Tarts with Heart. Now, what do you mean by that title?
Well, my cookbook, this is my third cookbook, and it is a book of vegan pie. So I guess the Pies and Tarts with Heart is a little nod to the ethics of eating vegan.
Uh-huh. So,
and also, I put a lot of heart and soul into all of these recipes, so it's also a personal nod as well.
Now, you said that you became vegan. Did you move from vegetarian to vegan?
I did. I'm 48 now. I've been vegetarian most of my life since I was 14. And I, other than a brief stint experimenting with trying to go vegan in my early 20s, I've been mostly vegetarian.
Well, I love your little whistle bird that you're supposed to put in pies. I have one, but I've never figured out how to use it.
Oh, well, they're called pie birds, and they actually have all sorts of animals and shapes if you look around at flea markets and antique stores. But it's a pie vent, and you just pretty much mold the crust around it, and the steam will escape through the bird's mouth or the critter's mouth. You can also cut some additional vents in. It's just so the pie doesn't bubble up.
Okay.
And they're cute, too. They're kind of cute. A nice little decoration.
They are.
I like mine. I talk to it, but I don't bake. So
What color is yours?
It's blue, isn't it?
Blue.
You have a bluebird.
Bluebird of pies. And I think our daughter-in-law uses it when she makes pies when she comes here.
Does she? I gave her one of mine.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
She has one in South Carolina.
Now, I'm looking at your explanation of your icons, and you have a lot of icons. So this means that you have recipes that meet various criteria, such as gluten-free. Then there's the clock says fast. Make this pie in less than 30 minutes. You have low fat, and there's your heart with a check on it. And it says pies are fattening, but these pies contain less fat than average. I don't like to think of pies because they're the only sweet I like. I don't like to think of them as fattening.
Well, they're less fattening than some pastries, so you've made a good choice.
And then you have kid-friendly recipes that especially appeal to kids. Now, by my standards, anything with sugar in it will appeal to kids.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah. And then you have raw, so you have a number of recipes for raw food, right?
Yes.
And then...
Now, how do you make raw pies? And do you serve it in raw pie crust?
Yes, you do. You make pie crust from nuts. So I use nuts as the crust instead of a flour-based crust.
Oh, okay.
And also a no-bake, which is my favorite kind of pie. You don't bake it. Actually, my favorite is fruit pies. A question. I mean, you are a vegan and you are a vegetarian for ethical reasons, which many people have, although a lot more people are moving in that direction, such as Meatless Mondays and all that, because of the health benefits.
Yes.
Do you recommend this as a health benefit?
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes, but the slightly longer answer is you can be a very overweight, unhealthy vegan. You can be malnourished and a vegan just like you can be a malnourished omnivore. It depends on what kind of food choices you make. If you eat only sugary pies, as much as I'd like to sell my cookbook, I'd like to be upfront. If you only eat sugary pies all day and made with white flour and lots of chocolate and stuff that's not really good for you outside of moderation, you're not going to be a healthy vegan. But if you, for example, my book has savory pies as well, which are loaded with vegetables and whole grains and the raw pies also. If you mix up your dietary choice of proper food, you can be a healthy vegan. But so that's the short answer. But, I mean, a vegan diet has definite health benefits. There's no cholesterol, obviously, and it's about eating whole foods and everything in moderation, including moderation, I like to say.
That's a cool saying. It's the hardest thing. I imagine the hardest thing about dealing with a vegan in baked goods of any sort, what I envision to be probably the most difficult problem dealing with vegan baked goods would be how to handle the fat. Its function in the baked good and what it does to texture as well as taste.
See, I can see why people might think that, but there are lots of vegan plant-based fats that are used in baking with great success. Yeah. Well, coconut oil, for example, you can use this fabulous, it's a vegetable margarine called Earth Balance, which is my favorite. I don't like to recommend brands very often, but that's one brand that I stick to, Earth Balance. It's got a very buttery flavor, and it's a wonderful texture. Lots of folks also swear by using olive oil in their pastries, and in fact, there are lots of cakes that use olive oil as a fat, and canola oil, and all kinds of oils. So there are lots of fats that are
fat-based. Well, if it's not the fat, then what is the most difficult aspect of baking vegan?
You're asking the wrong girl, because I really don't think it's difficult. I think it's a myth. I think it's a little bit of a stereotype, because most people are, it's a paradigm shift. Most people are brought up thinking you have to include dairy and butter and eggs and everything, and it's just not so. If you look around the country and see the amount of fabulous plant-based bakeries that are enjoying so much success right now, I mean, they're delicious foods and delicious pastries without any eggs or dairy. So, I mean, I guess, so the short answer is that it's just learning some new tricks. And it's not that difficult. It's just a paradigm shift.
And now here's one, easy cheeseburger pie, which is savory. I can just imagine how many calories are in this little baby.
Well, this little baby, it's not the prettiest pie. You know, some of the best foods are not the prettiest foods, but
right. This
one does not have as many calories as a regular cheeseburger pie, because the base for this is called textured vegetable protein, and it's basically a very low-fat soy product. So the only thing that's really fattening on this pie is the crust, and a pie crust that's made with flour and shortening of any kind is going to be a little fatty. And also the vegan cheese on top. But again, even with vegan cheeses, they vary. Some of them are more fattening than others. So it can be fattening, but it's not quite as fattening as the traditional omnivore cheeseburger pie.
Yeah, Pennsylvania Dutch corn pie. I never even heard of that one.
Well, there's an interesting story behind this pie. For those of your listeners who are not from Philadelphia, where I live, there's a county near us, a few counties, where the Amish people live. They call them Pennsylvania Dutch. They're not actually Dutch. That's a bastardization of the word Deutsch, which means German. They're Pennsylvania German. And this corn pie is a Pennsylvania Dutch recipe. And when I was going to college, my then-boyfriend's landlady, and this recipe is in memory of her, Edna Brumbach, used to make this pie for my then-boyfriend and I. And it's just basically a double-crusted pie. It's filled with corn on the cob, corn kernels, excuse me, and potatoes, and it's really delicious. She used to pour milk over it too, so it's just one of those carbolicious comfort foods that's great in the winter. But you can certainly pour soy milk over it or almond milk or not. I really like this pie. It's good when you need a little bit of comfort.
And tell me, why throw in also the gluten-free recipes? It's
well,
everybody seems to be gluten intolerant lately.
Well, I'm not gluten intolerant. I'm very lucky that I'm not gluten intolerant. But you're right. I've been noticing that as well. A lot of people are gluten intolerant. And it is a fact that we consume way too much wheat in society. So it can lead to issues. I mean, I think it's good to mix up your grains anyway. As I said, moderation in everything. And most of our flours in this culture are wheat-based. So, you know, it's good to mix up your foods. But I wanted to give options for everyone. I think it's got to be horrible if you've got a gluten sensitivity issue and you can't make certain recipes because there's no option. It's relatively easy to throw a few crust recipes in here and options for gluten-free folks so they can modify these recipes. I'm a big believer in trying to make recipes as modular as possible. I will give folks the springboard to start with, and then they can tailor things to suit their own diets or their own pantries or their own tastes.
Well, and now you have an intriguing story here called, it's what the recipe called, Heart Tart for Art. I can hardly say it.
Heart Tart for Art. Yeah. That was an interesting story. This was on my original blog, which it's no longer up. I've changed the blog address, but one of the first contests I had was a tart contest, and it was T-apostrophe-A-R-T. So I had asked my readers to send in pictures of their tarts and recipes. And this lady, Vicky Hodge, who was one of my earliest friends on the blogosphere, created this recipe for her husband, Art, to celebrate their wedding anniversary. So it was a double entendre because it was an artistic contest, but it was also for her husband, Art. And Vicki is still one of my very good friends.
And,
so I would like to include her recipe.
These are heart-shaped, made out of phyllo sheets.
Yes.
I imagine you could lose your mind. I remember making something with phyllo, I think 200 or whatever it was, thinking I was having something close to Chinese water torture.
You have to work kind of quickly, but the good news is you can make these from puff pastry squares as well, which is a little easier. You don't have to fuss with the phyllo as much.
Now, what are some of your other favorites? I mean, I'm looking at the chocolate bourbon pecan pie. Now, don't tell me that's low in calorie.
Oh, I don't think anything with nuts is really low calorie, but you can have a smaller slice, right? Some of my favorites. I'm not the biggest chocolate person. I mean, I do enjoy chocolate, but I'm not a chocoholic. So this said, I really lean toward tropical flavors and citrusy flavors. Those are my weaknesses. So I like, in this book, from the sweet side, I like the lemon fluff pie. That's definitely one of my favorites. I also like the chocolate, I call it the Choco Cocoa Macadamia Nut Pie. Now, that's really, talk about fattening, that's very decadent. You just need a little tiny slice, and you're good to go. And I also like the retro strawberry pie. There's just something so wholesome about that pie, and it's just so pretty with the ruby red strawberry color. It just reminds you of a more innocent time.
Now, before we conclude the interview, it occurs to me that you said that you changed your blog, but you now have an active blog under a different name. Would you like to share that with our listeners?
Oh, sure. My blog is urbanvegan.net. It used to be urbanvegan@blogspot.net, but I just changed it after my divorce. I took some stuff down. But I've been at this address for, gosh, many years now. So it's urbanvegan.net, and I'm also on Twitter, @TheUrbanVegan, and you can find me on Facebook as well, under Urban Vegan.
You're just everywhere. You're just all
real, I'm a social butterfly.
real urban and real vegan. How about that? Well, it's a fascinating book, especially for someone who is a born carnivore.
But you're a carnivore or an omnivore?
Probably an omnivore with a tendency towards carnivore, I think.
Okay.
meat wasn't always available in quantity in my household when I was a child, so I'm making it up for it now. But we can still be friends.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, and you do approach it with a certain attitude, and when you describe the recipes as cruelty free, that's taking a position, isn't it?
Well, is it taking a position, or is it really just simply stating the truth? I don't know that it's an attitude. I think there's no creatures are harmed when you're using the ingredients for these pies, unless you happen to slice your finger while you're cutting something.
Well, now, hold on a second. We did have someone on the program who said that she thought she heard carrots squeal when they were pulled out of the ground.
Let me
just say something. Carrots don't have a central nervous system. So if I slammed a carrot with a hatchet, it probably wouldn't scream, but if I slammed a pig with one, it would probably scream. So I think it's all about the central nervous system.
All right. Well,
people pull that one.
Well, we have to be careful not to get too far astray here, because we certainly encourage people from exploring this really excellent book.
Just saw your recipe for the Cornish pasties, which, you know, you got a range of stuff with that.
Yeah, they're pretty modular. You can put pretty much whatever you'd like in those.
You know, you bought ones in Cornwall. Are really skimpy on the filling.
Well, there's not much meat in them, but But I guess in yours there wouldn't be any meat anyway.
But they're filled.
There's no meat. Nope.
All right. Well,
here's kale pie. That's another one.
Kale pie is actually my favorite savory recipe in the book. It's the North African inspired kale pie. It's really good.
Well, and
it's got raisins and pine nuts and all kinds. It's kind of a combination of sweet and savory. So,
right.
It's speaking of healthy foods, this one's healthy.
Well, I mean, a lot of them look healthy. Like the raw clementine pistachio tart looks very healthy. Anyhow,
I've
touched all the bases here, and
I
wish you a lot of luck with your book.
Well, thank you so much for including me. I really appreciate the time, and it's been fun.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, Denise.
Thank you both.
You'd be blessed as a vegan to have all these wonderful flavors.
It's nice to know that something good comes out of Philadelphia. Sometimes we wonder if anything does, but you have, and we thank you very much for that.
And thank
you so much for joining us today on The Menu.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
And we'll have another track right after a quick break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We think you'll get a clue from the fact that the next book is called Bake and Destroy. Our guest in the final segment is an interesting and challenging personality, and her book has a funny title too. Go ahead, love.
Well, it's called Bake and Destroy: Good Food for Bad Vegans.
There you go. Okay, so that was the piece I missed out.
I couldn't remember the thing. The thing is that she's not what you expect. The introduction's by a pro wrestler. She's punk and tattooed, but she sure knows how to bake.
and her name is Natalie Slater.
I have a question, Natalie Slater, to start this all. First of all, I should mention that you are a creator of a very, very popular blog called BaconDestroy.com. And your new book is called Bacon Destroy, subtitled Good Food for Bad Vegans. But the whole thing is really, it presents you as a punk. You're tattooed, pierced.
Yes.
Is this the image that you went for?
Really an extension of my personality. I'm very outgoing. I think if you have as many tattoos as I do and a kind of distinctive look, that you have to be a people person or you're going to have a pretty miserable time, because people definitely want to talk to you and ask you questions a lot. And so I think I brought all of the energy that I typically have in my day-to-day life in the book. I'm definitely not a scary, mean punk rocker that's going to try to pick fights on the street or anything. I'm very approachable, but the book is definitely an extension of kind of all the silly, goofy things that I enjoy.
Yeah, well, it's really kind of startling. You've been described as a skilled crafter, writer, and baker, as well as a mom of a 7-year-old, but also you're described as Martha Stewart meets Iron Maiden. Which I loved.
Yes. Well, I admire Martha Stewart very much. I always correct people when some people try to describe me as maybe the anti-Martha or something like that. But I love Martha Stewart. I watched her show when I was a stay-at-home mom every day religiously. I learned a lot from her. I really love that she has made it a point of pride for people again to do things themselves, to cook for themselves, to build things, to sew. And I think that that's actually a pretty punk rock credo as well. You know, typically in the punk world, everybody sort of does things for themselves. You make your own clothes, you find your own way. And so I definitely have been influenced a lot by Martha Stewart and her kind of whole mission, but I definitely have my own spin on it.
I'm not going to ask you about Paula Deen. That wouldn't be fair.
Let's not go there.
But what about this wrestler who wrote the foreword? Mm-hmm. I mean, is he a relative? Or?
He's a very good friend of mine. We grew up together. We've been friends for almost 20 years. And when he was coming up in the wrestling world, it's really when I was first kind of getting into veganism. And so he would have these little independent wrestling shows where kind of the up-and-coming guys had matches for, like, you'd pay like $10 and you could watch all these wrestlers. And so I would bake vegan brownies or whatever I was experimenting with, cookies, and he would bring them to the shows and bring them backstage, and it was always a good test for me to see if the recipe worked, see if all these wrestlers would eat it and not ask any questions about it. So when it came time for the book, I thought he would be a great guy to write the foreword, because you would never really think of a pro wrestler when you start talking about vegan food, but the way that our friendship has gone, it's really been hand in hand as I've kind of developed my own way and started my own career. His career took off. I mean, he's a huge name in professional wrestling now. So
he is. Now, just for those people who know professional wrestling, or we don't, let's
CM Punk.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know CM Punk was a wrestler. I would have thought CM Punk was a rapper.
Well, what I want to know is, what are the secrets you have on him and him on you?
Oh, all kinds of things.
but they're a secret. you can't put them out of the air. They're a secret.
Now, you have wonderful titles. I mean, you have obviously a great sense of humor. And you mix up sweets and savories, right?
Yes. My website is primarily sweet, but over the past few years, really with sort of the growing popularity of social media sites like Instagram, where you can kind of quickly snap a photo of what you're having for lunch or for dinner. Once I started doing that, I started getting a lot of interest from people in the savory stuff. Like, what does the Bake and Destroy household have for dinner? All I know is what kind of cupcakes you had, but what do you have for dinner? What do you have for lunch? So that was kind of the idea behind the book. I put desserts first because that's kind of what I've known for, but then kind of take the reader through breakfast, side dishes, dinners, snacks, and all sorts of things.
Yeah, and you have chapters on tips, tools, and magic, and also on the weirdo ingredients, which I think's funny. But this one, Peter liked this title too, Crouching Cornbread, Hidden Broccoli.
Yes.
Which any mother would understand how important that one is.
Absolutely. Sometimes, even though he's been vegetarian his whole life, I still have to pull one over on my son sometimes to get him to eat broccoli.
And, of course, you have the requisite kale everything. I haven't seen a cookbook in all year that doesn't have some kale recipe in it, even a dessert book.
Yeah, as much as I try to not necessarily be on trend all the time, there's no denying kale. Everybody is really into kale right now. So we have lots of fun at home making kale chip and all kinds of things. So I thought I would throw some of our favorite kale chip recipes in there.
Have you ever made a study of who flocks to your blog? What are these people like?
Yeah, primarily it's really funny because most of my audience, I'm really just sort of talking to myself. It's a lot of early 30s moms, career women, people who sort of maybe came up listening to punk rock or heavy metal and who are find themselves sort of domesticated these days. And so that's really the bulk of who is reading my blog, although there are a growing number of men, probably thanks to my connection to my pro wrestler friend.
That was true. I never thought.
Definitely. But for the most, it's like early 30s kind of young moms, career women. That's about it.
Just fits right in.
Yeah.
Perfect book for us, right?
Some people will look at this and think you've lost it. You've got mac and cheese balls, B-A-L-L-Z. Tell us about those.
So that's my mac and cheese recipe was handed down to me from my friend Eric, who owns a skateboard shop in Detroit, and he's been vegan for over 20 years, and he knows all the tricks. So he gave me his mac and cheese recipe, which is made with nutritional yeast instead of cheese, but it has a really cheesy flavor. And so I took that recipe and I kind of used my ice cream scoop and I dunked the mac and cheese in batter and deep fried it I like to take a healthy dish and maybe give it a smack and make it maybe a little bit less healthy and a little bit more fun when it's time to make food for parties.
Yeah, how about pizza cupcakes?
Yeah, see, that's, you know, I always have my 7-year-old in mind, and that's just kind of a fun little side dish for him. He likes to have those with, you know, with his spaghetti, or he likes to dip them in his soup.
And pretzel dogs of the dead.
Yes.
Falafel waffle. You have so much stuff here. What's a panzanella, which I love. A spaghetti cake. I just read something where the spaghetti burger is replacing the ramen burger.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So, anyhow, but you have such a broad range here. You don't have to worry about trends such as cupcake trends going away or anything like that. You hit it all. You even have quinoa pot pie.
Right.
So, I think that people are going to enjoy this because they will pick up on your sense of humor. After a while, I think everybody gets dead tired of this serious, you know, almost religious approach to food, don't you?
I agree. I think it should. Obviously, I have some cookbooks that are just absolutely dog-eared from use in my kitchen that I love and I wouldn't want to live without. But I didn't see a lot of people just really sort of having fun in the kitchen. And I think that's really a big part of if you're going to do something like dabble in the vegan lifestyle, if it's not fun, you're not going to stick with it. It can be a lot of work, and sometimes it can be tough to go out to restaurants and things like that. So I really wanted to make it really fun for people so that hopefully they'll stick with it.
You really do have to get into it and have a system, because I remember having to do Thanksgiving for my vegan cousin.
Oh, okay.
And that's the first time I really had to read every single label. I mean, they sneak meat and dairy and stuff in everything.
I know. It's surprising.
Yeah. So here are your directions. By Be My Fantasy Pizza, tips for epic pizzas plus a recipe for not parm. Then you break it down. Break it down, get stoned, and throw up. How can somebody not find that just hysteria? Yeah, there was one quote I was just looking for that I loved from you. Now I can't seem to find it. But I think it's just a wonderful, welcoming, open concept, this whole book. So I think people should, even if you're not vegan, although there are plenty of vegans to support a cookbook these days, huh?
Definitely.
Yeah, and go on your website, it's bacondestroy.com. And what else can we say? You said some people were born to what?
To rock and roll.
And you were born to put
mashed potatoes on pizza.
I love it. Natalie, thank you for talking to us.
Well, thank you very much.
And I hope that your son's first day at school was good.
I'm sure.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So there you have it. If you can't fix decent desserts for Thanksgiving now, nobody's going to save you.
And also, happy Hanukkah and happy...
Yeah, all of that too.
And happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Yeah, and be sure to join us again next week. Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.